thank you. First, I want to thank the organizers and Drive and David and Andrea to invite me to this nice place and to share with you some of more recent results. I am going to talk about small circuits Is it on? No? It has a green light. Okay. So I'm going to talk about circuits, but it's very small circuits in an artificial environment. When talk about so compared to the past few past couple of weeks that we have heard a lot of about circuits and expected the connecton scenario that we've seen the enormous complexity of circuits. But what I'm going to do here is trying to actually I've been always inspired by Chuck's talks and I want to follow Chuck's footsteps and to ask a few simple questions out of the complexity. And basically the question is how can the functional circuits arise from such complexity? Is there any rule that we can or principles that we can understand that we can figure out to understand how this actually happens? So for this audience, I think the question how the circuits arise it's the answer is probably obvious that we all know that neuroplasticity plays a key role in driving this circuits to self-organize to make it useful to be functional but I'm a experimentalist, so to know only the to know about that plasticity play a role, or more specifically that maybe activity-driven plasticity can force or drive the formation of functional circuits through things like attractor dynamics, for example, like John Hopfield have pioneered and also talked about this briefly in his talk two weeks ago, and David has talked about this feedbacks and attractors. What I want to know is exactly how this happens. So can we see this process in action. So that's part of the reason we choose this simple system. And the hope is by studying, by watching how this happened, we might be able to actually get some, to not only learn to see how it actually happened, we might also be able to get some surprises, and maybe if we're lucky, might be able to find out some new principles. When talk about plasticity, this is something I don't have to introduce to this audience, but I just want to show here. And this is Hebb's famous postulate about how plasticity can work. Of course, Hebb's rule is actually part of a larger scheme of Hebb's theory on the so-called cell assembly. And I'm going to I'll come to that after the next couple of slides. And so spec timing dependent plasticity is something that I we use as an experimental as an experimental notion or more quantitative notion for HAPS Hybin plasticity rule. And the reason I show this this here is not only because it's important for what I'm going to talk talk about later for the organization of the self-organization of the circuit, but also I want to show you a little bit on this variance of spec timing STDP rules, which is this modulation of STDP by dopamine. Actually, I think this is probably be of interest to some theorists. Actually, this is something. I was inspired when I was visiting Jerusalem, and Robert and Ham, we were talking talking about I think the early phase of Robert's Templetron story, and we were talking about how STDP or how plasticity can be should be modulated because a Templetron has to be supervised, and a dopamine or some other modulator can serve as a supervisor signal. So it took us a long time to compared to the model. It took us a long time to come up with the experimental results. But it's interesting that. With in the presence of dopamine, this STDP window has dramatically changed. So it's broader than the under control conditions, and also the depression part actually got inverted. So it's more favoring potentiation and less strict, and also if for the induction, the sensitivity is increased in term in that you need much fewer spec pairs in order to evoke to induce significant potentiation. So that's the this is a. Hippocampal neurons in culture, in culture still. So it's the same same culture that we did the earlier STDP experiments, but just by adding dopamine during the time when you induce STDP, you get a different induction rule. So this is I'm not sure how this is how useful this is to Templetron now, but perhaps it's something worth investigating the implication of such change in the rules might be interesting. What I'm going to more focus on today is mainly the other part of HAPS idea or HAPS theory is that in order to the reason that HAP proposed the Hybin plasticity rule is that he wants this rule to drive the formation of a small closed loop circuit that he called the cell assembly. And I'm sure everyone knows that. And the key feature of the assembly is that it can maintain persistent firing and reverberatory activity within this circuit. It's, so that if you have an input, a brief input, it can maintain its activity. The activation of the network can persist after the input is gone. So it gives you a shorter memory trace. And that's the basic idea, and the plasticity rule basically can make this happen, can make this circuit grow into such such thing. So I tend to regard this cell assembly as a basic form of functional circuit, or the most elementary unit for as a functional circuit. And this is a Hebb's diagram of how this rubric activity can go. It's basically follow some simple tracks. It seems very simple that just different populations or pathways has been activated along certain sequence, and it goes within this. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So it's just goes with persists within the circuit, and the when during this activity plasticity plays a role in that when you have this when you have this rewarding activity repeating over and over again, then synaptic plasticity happens, so that these connections become stronger, and that basically can drive the formation or drive the growth of this assembly, so that you can see that you can regard this as the emergence of functional circuits. So that's Hebb's idea. And the in vivo correlates of for Hebb's idea, it's probably mostly studied in working memory tasks, that people have been able to see this. And this is Funahashi et al. This classical work on visual working memory, that when the monkey has watched a fixation point, and then a cue come up in a certain location at the peripheral, and then it come and go, and the monkey has to remember after the after this visual cue is, has disappeared, until the fixation point turns off, and then the monkey has to make a cut to that location. So during this during this delay period, where there's no visual cue at this location, the monkey in the prefrontal cortex, there are cells that fire persistently, that is lasting through this delay period, and just terminated by the reward signal afterwards. So during this time, there are neurons are active, and the most probable hypothesis is that this is probably driven by this assembly, or this small circuit that keep maintain this active firing. So that's in vivo evidence, but people don't really know, even though this is only one scenario, that there are multiple, as because we are only looking at firing of a number of neurons, and there are multiple mechanisms that potential mechanism that can cause this. So for example, like the neurons itself can be bistable. So and then when you have activity, the a single neuron can maintain the persistent firing. So it's not necessarily rewarding activity. Our question is by using a reduced system, we want to ask whether rewarding activity can indeed exist in neural networks, no matter what kind of network it is, but whether this, whether we can actually see rewarding activity. And if yes, what are the underlying cellular mechanisms? What exact, what currents, for example, maintains such activity? And then along the line of Hebb's theory, can activity induce synaptic plasticity cause the emergence and growth of rewarding activity? And in the end, I also want to talk about will network activity in turn influence synaptic plasticity? So we use this reduced system in culture that has maybe 100 neurons or so, and they grow on an island of astrocytes. So they make connections. When they grow there, they make connections. They can be active, and you can use a patch electrode to record their activity. This is again hippocampal neurons that we took the embryonic right and dissociated the hippocampus and played them on culture, and the glass cover slip was the pattern. We basically used patterned activity, we used patterned substrate, used a rubber stamp to stamp polylysine on the cover slip as dots, and then that they will be sticky and neurons will grow into this island. So in those islands, normally when you stimulate a neuron, you see not only an action potential but also some polysynaptic activity, and that's because this neuron is connected to other neurons nearby, and those neurons, those neurons can fire action potentials and feedback into this neuron you are recording from. So those are polysynaptic potentials. And the interesting thing is that in some networks, a single stimulation not only trigger these polysynaptic potentials, but also sometimes it can trigger this long-lasting activity and fires over and over again. Yes. It's a mixture of basically whatever you have in the hippocampus at that stage. If they survive the culture, they will be there. So you have pyramidal neurons, interneurons, and glia cells. And most pyramidal neurons probably are like 80%, and inhibitory neurons like 20%, 10 to 20%. Proportion is probably similar. If the culture is good, then it's probably similar to what you see in vivo. But the connectivity is it's random, randomized. So. So they are usually like 2 weeks in culture, 2 to 3 weeks in. When you take them out, they are they were like a few days before born. So like embryonic 18. These are hippocampal neurons. We actually want to try different brain areas like cortical or amygdala or other places to see whether they have different properties. But that's something still undergoing. One possibility is that this persistent activity is driven by reverberatory activity in the network. So that's one obvious possibility. But another possibility is that this neuron itself may be bistable. So when you inject a little bit current, it goes to an up state and it stays there and for a while if you have enough persistent sodium channel, for example. It's easy to test whether that's a case by just hold the cell in voltage clamp. So at least we can see that under voltage clamp, you can still get this persistent polysynaptic currents. So that indicates that neurons nearby are still persistently firing and in certain patterns, and that indicate that at least the persistent activity is not by stability of this neuron itself. So it may be by stability of other neurons in the network, but at least it's not by this neuron you are patching. And if you stimulation is just so under voltage clamp, you just give a brief depolarization, and that because your clamp is imperfect, you can't clamp the axons. So you give a brief depolarization, the axon will basically generate action potentials. So you can still, and the rest of the cells, you can still hold roughly and under voltage clamp, but the axon will send the signal out. Oh no, no. Stimulation is just current into the single cell, depolarization into the single cell. So it's you're not controlling any other cells in the dish. Durations. The statistics of the durations. Let's see afterwards. So, the resting potential of this neuron is usually minus 55-70. It's still just similar to most other neurons. And so if you blow up this waveform, you can see there are multiple components within this each small burst, and in between there is a period of a relatively silent period, and those are about 50 to 100 milliseconds, and this bursting activity was also lasts for about 50 milliseconds, and the so here you can sort of see kind of statistics of this network itself. So the duration varies from network to network, but it's reasonably stable for a given network. It's usually about so in this one, in this case was about 6 to 10 seconds, and that's yeah. That's right. You stimulate only one neuron. So, intracellularly, you generate this kind of thing. So the reason is that it's basically triggers the activation of other cells, and because it's in culture and it's confined, so the connectivity between cells are stronger than in vivo. So a single cell can drive some other cells to fire. Yeah. So each line, each color line is a trial, and we use. This is the same neuron in the culture. So. Yeah. Sometimes it comes. Sometimes it couldn't. So it's you. That's right. So it's our nine. Whether so you can initiate a reverberation. We call this reverberation. If you either initiate reverberation or you fail to initiate reverberation. If you fail, you get only polysynaptic currents like this blue trace, like a 50 milliseconds or so. Yeah. So we'll see that in the next video. The periodicity is not completely. This is one of the clean ones, and it's not very reproducible. But roughly, it's like 5 to 10 hertz. Yes. Okay. In this case, you very occasionally you get a burst. This is once a minute in, so it's depend on network. Some networks can be silent all the way until you stimulate, and some networks have a lot more spontaneous activity. And usually, the older and bigger ones have more spontaneous activity. That's just more. Yes. It's usually like 10 to 20%. Yeah. The epileptic. This kind of waveforms. Yeah, it's probably it can be similar to some of the after it, it's called after ictal activity or something. Yeah. But it's but this is a lower firing rate, right? So it's the neuron, a single neuron firing within this burst, it usually fire only once or twice, so it's much lower compared to real epileptic form. We do see under some with some treatment, you know, the culture can exhibit more epileptic form activity that has much higher firing rate. It can go up to like 100 hertz or so. But here it's usually 5 to 10 hertz firing. We'll see in the in calcium imaging later. So from here, basically, we can guess that it can be a reverberatory activity within the network, but we want to see exactly how they look like. So we use we use calcium imaging to see this, and here this movie is a compressed. It's a movie that extended. From real by 10 times compared to real time, so it's 1 second activity we played in 10 seconds. So you can see that the stimulation was here. So the activity first spread out, and then it generated itself. So it first started from here and then spread out to the network, and then it goes around. So the total number of neurons that were involved in this this reverberatory mode, it's probably like 30 to 50% of the network. So this is not raw calcium signal. I did some computation. It took the difference between frames. Mainly, it's a difference between frames, and then normalized by noise level. So it's a probability. It's a kind of confidence level of a neuron that's firing during this frame. So. Because calcium signal accumulates, so it takes the difference that's more reflecting the firing of the neuron, and this is what happens when you do pair pulse. So sometimes in some networks you don't see give a single pulse stimulation, you don't see any this long lasting reverberation, but when you give pair pulse stimulation, you can trigger reverberation. So that's this is how we sort of figured out the mechanism that sustains the reverberation, because if you look at compare single pulse with pair pulse, you can see that after the second pulse you get a lot more this tail current. You have a lot more, and this tail current we guess it's probably asynchronous release of transmitters at the presynaptic terminal. So when you give multiple stimulations because of accumulation of calcium at the terminal, you get more asynchronous release. So we thought if maybe it's this kind of pair pulse facilitation of asynchronous release that's important for the reverberation. Yes. Is that this is about 200 milliseconds. Usually, pair pulse is more it's effective when it's 100 to like 300 milliseconds.
You're looking at the response of the cell which you're stimulating, right?
Yes.
And so, why is there a latency? What is
oh, you mean from here, this simulation? Oh, first and second. Yeah, yes. So the first and second, that's probably the second stimulus you activate more cells. So these are polysynaptic neurons. So you stimulate this neuron, you activate. Oh, the stimulus was only 1 millisecond brief depolarization. Yeah, one millisecond depolarization, just to, enough to trigger an action potential in this cell. Same neuron. Yes, same neuron. Yes. In this guy, didn't have obvious haptic connection. Maybe a very small one here, but it's, you couldn't. But typically, maybe like also like 20% of cells, you can see autoptic connections, and the autoptic connection actually decreases over time in culture, probably because SDDP doesn't favor autoptic connections. So so we did a further experiment to try to figure out. Whether asynchronous release is indeed important for reverberation. So we block asynchronous release by adding EDTA AM in the culture. So it goes into the cells and chelate calcium within the cell. And that that pretty much eliminate most of the reverberation. Yes? So. This is Chuck's Chuck probably. This Chuck has done a lot of pioneer work on this, and Yuki Goda, when she was postdoc with Chuck, and she found that in this hippocampal cultures, there's asynchronous release that. That basically it's you stimulate a neuron, you have a synaptic current, but after if you look carefully, after each stimulation, you see not only the main synaptic currents that last for maybe 20-30 milliseconds, but also you see a small like miniature release following this, so that has a time constant of maybe a couple hundred milliseconds. And that can be increased by more repetitive stimulation. So you have more and more of that if you stimulate more. And this people call this asynchronous release. And that's a key feature of asynchronous release is that because it's depend on the residual calcium in the presynaptic terminal. So the more stimulation you have, the more asynchronous release you can get. So it's kind of a perpause or short-term facilitation in the cell, and you can use strontium so to trigger more asynchronous release, and that that you also have more reverberation. So so that's and this is a model that Vladislav Volman did when he was a graduate student with Asher Ben Jacob, and so he did a model on the on basically simulate you make a small network simulated network, and was able to generate a reverberatory activity basically use based on synaptic mechanisms including asynchronous release, and that he can he can get a reverberatory activity very similar to what we saw in culture. So I want to briefly summarize this, and we have seen the persistent reverberatory activity in this small network of neurons in culture, And this reverberation is it's somehow different from HAPS original reverberatory activity that's basically a kind of random reverberation within the network. But what we saw here in the small networks, we saw rhythmic activity that contains repetition of similar spatial temporal patterns of neuronal firing. And then as to the cellular mechanism, we found that reverberation is driven by recurrent excitation sustained by asynchronous transmission, which can accumulate over time. Yes. So when you you mean after you stimulate? Of the asynchronous activity, you mean? Spontaneous. You mean spontaneous activity without stimulation, or spontaneous activity after? Oh yeah. Yes. Right. Oh, the level of so if we go back to this, maybe actually, let me see. So we can see this. So the, I'll just come back to your point afterwards. But now the question is, how does the reverberation emerge in the network? So that's what we want to see. And this is the same slide that I showed earlier, that when you stimulate, when there's this network, you can you can't stimulate, you can't evoke reverberation by single pulse stimulation, but you can evoke reverberation with pair pulse stimulation. But if you look carefully, actually, this in this episode, reverberation actually started before pair pulse stimulation, and it's once it started, the second stimulation didn't affect the network activity at all, and the activity itself looked very much similar to what's stimulated by pair pulse stimulation. So it's the network basically is. It's basically the reverberation. It's like an action potential in a single neuron. So it's our neuron, and once it's initiated, it's similar. It's sort of it's not a we actually we it's a very interesting question. We try to look at whether a network has a specific resonance frequency, but it turned out not very the precise frequency is not very important. It's as long as you are at between 100 to 300 milliseconds. So we usually use 200 milliseconds interval, and that's more effective. And mainly because this falls within the time constant of asynchronous release. So that's roughly 200 milliseconds or so. Yeah. So the interest. Put which one? Which last speaker? You mean the? Oh, if you hear them. No, we didn't. I should have done this, but but it's 10 hertz, about 10 hertz. It's yeah, so like theta. What you have seen the space cell firing is probably similar to those.
There seems to be another oscillation in the quiet.
You mean during the quiet period? Oh, you mean here?
No.
During this, those are not really oscillation. Those are I think there's no
real periodicity, it's more like asynchronous release that the minis. It's just an increased miniature release. So the key thing here is that after this, so this network initially, you couldn't evoke this reverberatory activity by single stimulation. But after you evoke this by per-pulse stimulation twice, and then the third time, this reverberation can start by itself. And so we didn't pay much attention when we published this, but later we focused on this and we found that you can later you can turn back to single pulse stimulation and you can still trigger reverberation after once it's it seems to have learned. So once it has learned, you can now this network is now stronger and you can trigger reverberatory activity after by single pulse. So that's what you see here. Initially, there's no reverberation, and then you use per-pulse to force some reverberation, and afterwards you can trigger reverberation like this. And the difference. So we want to see what is important here. And the obvious difference from between this and this is that you have a lot of activity after the stimulation now. And if you quantify this, this after per-pulse stimulation, later on, this polycinetic current, total polycinetic current, is much higher than before. So it's kind of RTP, but in terms of polysynaptic activity. And if this is a summary of many experiments like this, and you can see that in almost all cases you have a significant increase after in this total charge after this per-pulse stimulation that that forced reverberation. And this increase in charge is basically an increase in polysynaptic current, and that is probably because of more neurons are activated by your stimulation, by your initial stimulation of the patched neuron. And we use calcium imaging to see which how many neurons are activated now, and we see indeed there are more neurons activated. So there's a reasonable increase in this after this learning. And this increase, so if you think about this increase, it can be driven by multiple cellular mechanisms. It's the most obvious or most likely one is synaptic potentiation. If you have a potential, if your synapse is potentiated, then of course the stimulation will be more effective on activating cells in the network. So we look at synaptic currents, but here it's difficult to monitor the actual functional connectivity within the network. So we look at only miniature synaptic currents as an assay to just monitoring the overall synaptic activity, synaptic strength in the network. So what we did was to in this experiment we used per-pulse stimulation to trigger reverberation, and after that, a single pulse stimulation can also trigger reverberation. So this network has learned after this per-pulse stimulation, and then we can choose this silent period before the stimulation, and measure miniature synaptic currents during this period. So this synaptic current we count a lot of miniature currents during before per-pulse stimulation and plot out the cumulative histogram, and after per-pulse stimulation plot out the cumulative histogram and found that indeed there is a significant increase in the amplitude of miniature synaptic current. So that indicate that you do have overall synaptic potentiation in the network during this learning. And we use AP5 to block this learning. If it's indeed synaptic potentiation like SDBP, then in culture you can block that. We know that SDBP in this culture is NMDA receptor dependent. So we add AP5 in this culture, and in this it's actually turned out to be a more difficult experiment because NMDA current also is contribute to reverberation. So many networks can never reverberate anymore. But there are some networks you can still give purpose stimulation to trigger reverberation. But they never learn, so it's never, the reverberation never starts before the second pulse, and afterwards a single pulse never could trigger reverberation. So there's no increase in miniature synaptic currents. And this summarizes all the experiments of this pair pulse training, and we can see that so we choose this network, all the networks that before pair pulse training there's no reverberation, and then pair pulse stimulation can force the network to reverberate, and after that, all the networks that can respond to pair pulse stimulation have learned. So basically, a single pulse afterwards can trigger reverberation. Can always, so this is 100% learning, and in the present AP5, it's still no learning at all. So it's you can still in this few networks you can still trigger reverberation by purpose in the present AP5, but it never learns. It's, once it's done, you use single pulse stimulation, it never trigger reverberation. So that's summary, and the synaptic current summary is like this. Under normal conditions, there's a big change. It's about a 15% increase in EPSC amplitude, the spontaneous EPSC amplitude. And frequency increase, it can be due to residual calcium during reverberation. But in AP5, there's never increase. So this is consistent with the idea that synaptic plasticity indeed underlies this the emergence of this reverberatory activity. Usually, so in this normal control experiment, sometimes a single we did this. We give a pair pulse stimulation and see whether that triggers reverberation. If that doesn't trigger, we give another pair pulse and then give another. Usually it trigger. We give like 10 pair pulse stimulation at maximal, but sometimes only one is enough. So once it triggers reverberation, we give a single pulse stimulation and see if that's learned. No, this is like an hour in an hour time scale. So after means it's usually 20 minutes to an hour after the training. So that's because it's in culture and patch in culture usually last a couple hours. And this is another interesting phenomenon when we patch two cells. We stimulate one cell that can trigger reverberation, but stimulate the other cell doesn't trigger reverberation. So we thought, oh, this might be an interesting scenario where we can see whether we can study the interaction between these two pathways. So we stimulate both, of course, that triggers reverberation. Also, you can see that the reverberation probability seems to be a little bit higher than before. And then after that, the interesting thing is that after that, you stimulate cell 2 only. And now this cell 2 can trigger reverberation. So that indicates that you have an associate learning paradigm, that one active pathway can actually help the other pathway to learn to trigger reverberation. So this is to see the neurons being activated by the stimulation. So at the beginning, stimulating cell 2 trigger very few neurons, and stimulating cell 1 activate more neurons. And after this learning, stimulating cell 2 trigger more neurons, and similar to similar pattern, although there are some subtle differences, but similar pattern as the previous cell 1 stimulation. Yes. So in this case, the experiment actually is a little bit tricky in the sense that we are using very small networks. So with those networks, the spontaneous activity is very low, and most of the time they are not active at all. So if we use larger networks, then you have more spontaneous activity, and then you can't study things like this anymore. So we have to keep the network very small, like 50 to 100 cells within the network, and it's isolated from other cells in the same culture dish. So there's another thing where we notice in this experiment that when we try to use PARPOS to induce the emergence of reverberation. And in this experiment, for example, that we give two PARPOSes. The first PARPOS trigger a little bit reverberation, and then we give single pulse that didn't trigger reverberation. So then we give another PARPOS that trigger a longer reverberation, and then we went back to single pulse stimulation that triggered even longer reverberation, and then it stopped, so it doesn't grow any further. So it grows for like two or three episodes. But in the other kind of in some other experiments, we saw that when we give a purpose stimulation to trigger reverberation, we tried twice. And the third time here, the reverberation actually started before the second pulse, so it's considered learned. The network is considered learned. So the later three reverberation always started before the second pulse, so it's considered learned. But you can see that there's no increase in the reverberation duration. And the increase in duration indicates it's consistent with synaptic potentiation, because you can think about this that total synaptic strength is probably one rate limiting step for that limits duration of reverberation. So the reason that reverberation ends here is basically it's exhausted synaptic resources, that it's because of a rather long term, it's a slightly slow short-term depression that turns off the most of the synapses, and then you don't have enough drive to maintain the reverberation. But if the synaptic strength is bigger, then you can have longer reverberation. And so the growth of reverberation duration indicates there is a continuous increase in synaptic strength, and then but here in this case there's no increase in strength. There's no increase in duration, so that is probably no increase in synaptic strength, and that's so we figured that there must be two different kind of learning. One is in a network that's naive, that doesn't have reverberation at all, and then you use purpose reverberation to trigger reverberation, purpose stimulation to trigger reverberation, and that causes synaptic potentiation in overall synaptic potentiation in the network, and later on you can trigger reverberation in this network. But in this case, you see a lot. There are a lot of spontaneous activity here in this case, and that indicates that this network may already already be strong enough to sustain reverberation. But your input is not good, not strong enough. So this input you stimulate this input. It's similar to the previous one that. One input can trigger reverberation, but the other input couldn't. But when you give purpose stimulation that triggers reverberation, you cause synaptic potentiation in those input synapses, and then you can trigger reverberation with single pulse. So that indicates that. In this case, you already have a core network that can reverberate, and in this case, the network was immature. Here the difference is that the potentiation only doesn't have to happen within the network, but it can only happen in the input side. So it's compared to the whole population, a small percentage of the synapses can be needs to be potentiated. To test this, we look at synaptic potentiation in this network and compare. First we look at whether these networks can be split into two groups. One group was there is a growth in reverberation duration. So the first reverberation duration is shorter than the later steady state reverberation duration. So that's the red dots. And then the other type of network is that the first reverberation duration actually, the steady state reverberation is actually same shorter than the first reverberation. If you separate the networks into these two groups and compare their the synaptic change in these two groups, we find that there is a synaptic the normalized this is the EPSC amplitude. There is an increase in the first type of network in the spontaneous EPSC amplitude, but in the second type there is no increase at all. So that's consistent with the idea that in the second type, reverberation already exists, that they don't need any further potentiation. But that also indicates that these networks, once it's formed, reverberatory activity cannot further induce reverberation anymore.
The one thing about yes. that is, if you have spontaneous activity in the network, then you're spontaneous.
Uh-huh.
If you have no spontaneous activity, then your spontaneous EPSCs are really EPSCs. And so
okay.
The agreements there would be on the third graph over to the right, the agreements would be real miniature synaptic currents, and those would be, and the red ones would be mainly lobe synaptic.
We try to look at, in this case, in this network, the spontaneous activity is still relatively low. So in this this 40 about 40 minutes, there are maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 times of bursts of spontaneous activity, and there's very few single action potential, spontaneous action potentials in the network. So, or action potential, or evoked synaptic currents.
Put TTX
on. Oh yes, yeah,
and
that's
then,
right.
And
yeah.
Then record the amplitudes at the, after the TTX.
After TTX,
that
way, yes.
That way
you eliminate that. That's
whether
right.
Whether they were after
driven or
yourself, if you're not looking at.
That's right.
Happen to fire very low
spontaneously, yeah.
That's
yes. That's right, yeah. It's you can think that in that way that this network is so generally older networks tend to have behave like this more, but each network is different. So sometimes the maturation of in the different networks can be different. There is some stochasticity in this development process. It's just a history, I guess. Also the density of the neurons and just yes, it's once it's happened to once the reverberation this core circuit happened to form, it will be stabilized and then it's there. Which rate of firing you mean? Oh yeah. So basically, you definitely recruit new neurons in the sense that here, when you stimulate this network, there's no reverberatory activity. So only a small subset of neurons are activated by this input, and then. But after per-pulse stimulation, you trigger more. You basically recruit more neurons to be involved, and then trigger reverberation. And then, and after that, this you form this this reverberatory network. Yes, I think definitely you you. Let me see if. Couldn't see clearly, but it's likely that that you already recruit more neurons during this. It's a growth process that you have more and more neurons involved and stronger and stronger synapses. You mean rate of firing in the? But here we are looking at only synaptic currents, but the rate of firing is it's usually still 5 to 10 hertz. It never go very high. During which time it go very low? You mean at the end of? In the. Yes. I guess lowest around 5 hertz. So the gap is like 200 milliseconds. Within a reverberation, it's relatively steady. It's not a discrete distribution. It varies, right? So if it's 5 hertz, it's probably the gap probably like around 200 hertz, 200 milliseconds, and sometimes 100 milliseconds. Yeah, it's, this, so it's not not kind of a good pattern generator like you get this very highly reproducible rhythmic activity. It's more it's less precise than that. So in this case, you see. This actually illustrates how the about the growth and stopping of growth of reverberation, because we see that there is a growth here that consistent with increase in synaptic strength during this period of time, and then there is this reverberation duration doesn't grow any further, so it stopped around 7 to 8 seconds. And in this, after that, if you look at a network, sometimes the network has a reverberation to start with, and if you record for a longer time, it just never grow any further. So basically indicate that this reverberation. After it's stabilized, this there's no further synaptic strengthening anymore. So that actually is not consistent with the conventional having learning rule, right? Because you have reverberation, and the reverberation should further increase synaptic strength, and that should lead to longer reverberation. But here it doesn't happen any further. So this is indicates that something has stopped synaptic potentiation. Yes. You mean within each it's slowed down? Yes, it's probably because of the this short-term synaptic depression. So there's the. There must be a component of short-term depression that has time constant of seconds. And so we look at this further in a special case, a special network that we treated the network, inactivated the network for a few days with TTX. And in this network, you can trigger reverberation, and the reverberation can grow, but it doesn't stop like before. It grows further and further and longer, and eventually, in this case, it's basically turned into this continuous reverberation regime that doesn't stop anymore. So, but here, sometimes you have longer gaps between the bursts now, but still, it's the network itself. It's much more active, and you never see this in control conditions. So in the small networks, we only see this in this TTX treated networks. But of course, in the small networks, if you have larger network, a lot more neurons, like thousands of neurons, then you can have this kind of activity from the beginning of your patch. But in the small network, that like 100 neurons or so, you don't see that. Oh no! This afterwards, after treatment, after 2 days of TTX treatment, you wash it out. Yeah. You mean which is? So the difference compared to control networks is that first, this growth period, this growth phenomena lasts for a longer time of last for much longer. In control networks, it grows for maybe two or three episodes, and then it doesn't grow anymore. So it goes like this. So it grows and then stops more quickly. Yeah, the bottom is different. The bottom, you don't always see this, but very often you see this. Yes, it's possible, but it's just I guess the more interesting question is what stops its growth in control networks. That's right, yes.
So it would take longer. We're going to have a balance between increasing the release probability and increasing pool size. And so it would take them longer to run out.
Yes, so you mean during this time period, this tens of seconds, there is a depletion, a slow depletion in normal case.
Because they have their synapses.
If the synapses are bigger, yeah. But during this period, it's getting. It seems to be that the synapses are becoming bigger and bigger. Yes. Okay.
There's another alternative that has to do with how many
of
the cells get recruited.
That's right. Yes.
So have you calcium imaged those?
We imaged. Oh, you mean the TTX treated ones? We didn't image many of those. Most of the image were done in the control ones. Yeah.
Did you recruit more cells into the delivery pool?
So this is another experiment that just the cells were treated in TTX for longer period of time, and that basically from after the second. So the first parapulse stimulation triggered reverberation, and then the second one, it doesn't stop anymore. So that's another example. And here we also monitored. Actually, this partially answered Chuck's question like before, whether we added TTX afterwards. And to basically make sure that this what we were measuring were really minutes, and it looked like so during this period, what we measured here is pretty much similar to what we got here. So it's so they are pretty much minutes, and basically there is a big difference in the amount of synaptic increase. In the normal culture and in the TTX treated culture, and that difference was so this is frequency, like we don't talk about it now, and this difference is partially offset by AP5 by adding AP5, but here in control culture, if you add AP5, you have nothing, you have no. No potentiation at all, but in TTX treated culture, if you add the AP5, you still get some potentiation. So there are some AP5 NMD receptor independent potentiation in this TTX treated culture. In this case, we don't know whether this is so. We treated at TTX 2 days before the experiment, so we don't know which retranasin or. So let me summarize here and maybe show a few more slides afterwards. So I like to call this a self-organization principle or something for this small cultures, small culture networks through synaptic having plasticity. But we call this balance having plasticity. It's that first, this having potentiation can drive the emergence of and growth of reverberatory activity in this small circuit. And we think this can be considered as a prototypic having cell assembly in vitro. And then we saw that this experience of reverberatory activity can rapidly reduce the capacity for the synapse to be further potentiated. So there must be some kind of homeostatic regulation here. And we don't know exactly what mechanism underlies this regulation, but it seems like this homeostatic regulation balances having plasticity to ensure stability of active circuits in this small networks. We have reasonable reverberation. If you disrupt this homeostasis by treating the network with inactivating the network for 2 days or so, and then this network doesn't have enough balance, and then having plasticity will drive the network to into more and more reverberation, and probably to this unstable continuous firing regime. Yes. Yes. Avalanches, yes. These are much smaller networks. So in the avalanche network, those are high density, reasonably high density cultures. So they are actually organotypic cultures, slice cultures. So they have thousands or tens of thousands of neurons there. What we have, we basically confine the culture so that it's a small network that has only 100 neuron or so.
Also, the organic cultures have many more synapses per neuron.
That's right, yes, yes.
They're more connected.
We haven't looked at inhibitory currents per se. We can inhibit add bicuculant to inhibit inhibitory currents, and we can get reverberation. And sometimes those reverberation can look not as nice. So they're this the interburst or inter-event interval gets shorter, and sometimes the pattern of their activity looks not as clean. So and more neurons, most of the time, almost all neurons are activated during under those conditions. But with inhibition, we usually get like half or less neurons activated during reverberation. So it's there is this this ordering going on. The larger circuits. Larger circuits. Basically, I think the key thing is that this kind of reverberatory activity controlled under controlled controlled reverberatory activity. It's probably easier to be studied in small networks, but not in larger networks. Mainly because in larger networks you have more spontaneous activity. And then it's something that it's easily go into a quite random activity pattern, and we think in that sense the small network is nicer to study some simple principles, but with larger, but the network doesn't scale up automatically. If you want to scale up, you have to have a more precise wiring pattern to have a better balanced excitation and inhibition, all those things. But in culture, you can't do that. So you need the real brain to do that, I guess. So this, I'll skip this, some reflections on synaptic plasticity, I'll skip. And so now I want to just show you, quickly show you a few slides that what we are doing now, which in China. And this is because we have seen this, the synapses seem to be different in this under different conditions. So we see the growth of reverberation, we see the non-growth of reverberation, we see super growth of reverberation after TTX treatment. So we want to see what's the difference in the synapses. And one thing we are trying to do is to use super resolution imaging to see whether we can see the organization of synaptic proteins can be different. And this is just a technique that we are technical development. We just want to see whether we can get it to work. And this is Kamkanev staining, and we just get this super resolution imaging to work. You can see the conventional imaging, it's like this, and then super resolution imaging, it's like this, and it's much more crisp. And this palm storm kind of I guess exactly this should be called storm because we use the antibody labeled by Cy3Cy5 pairs and this is more palm. This we co-expressed two channels, but this is not in neurons, but in HEC cells, 293 cells that we try to study the to look at the localization of these two channels on the cell membrane. And you can see that basically with conventional imaging, you can't see at all how they co-localize. But with this palm, we get more discrimination about the. So that's basically just shows that the technology seem to work so far, and we still need to improve. And this we want to study the reverberation pattern more carefully, and that we use grow neurons on multi-electrode arrays and try to get higher temporal resolution on the activity of neurons. Because remember, when we use calcium imaging, we can sort of see some wave-like activity that seem to be repeating pattern. So we want to see, but the temporal resolution of calcium imaging is too low, and mainly because of camera rate and also calcium saturation. So we use MEA, and this is this network has this spontaneous reverberation, so we look at this episode, and it's when it's zoomed in, you see activity like this, and then you can so each you can see some kind of synchronized activity. So that's basically this correlated to the bursts of reverberation event we saw, and then there's an interval and then another burst, and interval another burst. So these are recorded from MEA. We try to do spec sorting to try to get single neuron, but we can't be sure. So those may be single neuron activity, some may be multi-unit activities still. So the sorting, I guess Alicia has more experience on this. I need to talk to is about this. And but we do find if when we look into this firing patterns carefully, and we do find something like this. A lot of events seem to be reproducing, seem to be basically repeating themselves. So we still have to quantify this just to understand how repetitive they are, but they, from first look, they seem to be the patterns are similar, and it's much. I think the similarity, if we believe they are similar, it's the occurrence of this repeating pattern is much much more than random. So in this case, it's repeated multiple times, and we just choose four times here. And then we want to, so another thing we want to do, I guess a lot of you have asked me before some, about whether this reverberation can happen in vivo. So we just started imaging in vivo, but we, there's no results yet. I just just to show this what we are trying to do. And the other thing is we try to use this optogenetic control to see whether we can train the network to learn certain pattern of activity. So that's still, all this still are still at the beginning. And these are the people who did the work, Pak-Min Lau, who was a research assistant professor at Pitt, and she's now a professor at in China. She discovered reverberation by chance sort of when she was trying to look for single synapse STDP. She found a network activity, so she switched to this. And Rick Gherkin, who was a graduate student, has graduated and is postdoc in CMU. He did the TTX treatment on the effect of TTX treatment on reverberation and on synaptic scaling. And these are other students in China who this. Ji Chuan was a postdoc with me, and he's now a faculty in China. He did the dopamine modulation of STDP experiment. And these are graduate students and a few undergrad students, very talented students who were pushing this new technology and tried to further the study. And Aisha Ben-Jacob and Velasco Bowman were collaborators with the modeling. And the last slide I want to show, this is the high-tech images and I want to show you. And this is where things, this pit and where this all this study was got started. And this is USTC in China, this building. We are now doing experiments. A lot of people are doing experiments here. And these are nearby sceneries, and this is the Yellow Mountain that's about 2-3 hours drive from here. And this this a village next to I think at the foot of the mountain. And you are all welcome to visit and spend time if you want to spend time in China. This might be a good place to actually get something done, hopefully, and also to refresh your mind in mountains and villages. Thank you. Okay. I hope it's still late.
Yeah,
we tried. So the beginning was because we were it's kind of large. We were studying we were using low density cultures like in Chuck's lab also to study STDP. But in the and sometimes low density cultures you get patches of networks that that contain tens or hundreds of neurons on the patch of glial cells. And in that experiment, we just happened to, I think the patch was even smaller, like 20 or 30 neurons on a patch of glial cells. And we were transfecting the cells with synaptic labels in order to study single synapse. So we were labeled the synaptic protein with GFP. And but the transfection rate was efficiency was very low. So there were only a few neurons that were labeled. So we have to patch every neuron that are green. And one of the neurons, so even if normally we may not patch them because they seem to be connected to a big network, we don't study them because we can't study STDP with too much polysynaptic activity. but there we have to do that. But then it happened to, when we stimulate, it happened to trigger this bursting activity lasts for a few seconds. And we thought, oh, that may be more interesting. So it's just purposely. And actually, Alicia, when he visited Pittsburgh, I asked him about how to make better controlled islands of cultures. Because there, before that, we could only do random islands. We culture low density and get random islands. But Alicia told me that you can just use rubber stamps to stamp polylysing patterns on glass. So that's what we did, and we were able to grow this 1 millimeter diameter islands. And then there, with the reasonably low density culture, you can get a couple hundreds. And when we try to increase and by chance or by purpose the number of neurons, and we found that larger networks you have too much spontaneous activity and seem to be random and they change all the time, so we decide that not to bother to study the high density ones.
So eventually you have to grow these things on glia, and
They were loaded together, and the reason you don't see anything in glia is because we took the difference between frames. So the glia calcium activity in glia is slow, so you don't see anything. But if you look at the raw data, you see that you trigger reverberation, and then after maybe a couple seconds into reverberation, you see activation of glia cells, and then there's a wave, calcium wave in the glia monolayers. We couldn't tell very much, so it certainly has nothing to do with the initiation of reverberation. So the first couple of seconds, you don't see glia activation at all, but then it may contribute to the. We couldn't always monitor, so. Yeah, so that we don't know. It could be related to glia, but I think the spontaneous activation was mainly just by random spontaneous transmission in the culture. If you have so that's also why when you have more cells, you have more spontaneous events, because it's just by chance. No. This burst of spikes is that you have in each burst, this 50 millisecond or 100 millisecond burst, you have each neuron fire only once or twice, but you have but many neurons are firing. It's not a single neuron firing multiple times, many times. With Celtium imaging, it's very difficult to tell, but I don't have the data here, but normally you see stepwise increase in Celtium, and when the signal noise is the best, you might be able to tell a single spec versus two specs. If they happen closely, you can see a step and then another step, but normally it's difficult to tell how many specs. Within noise, it's hard to calculate. With MEAs, then you don't know whether it's the same cell or another cell. It's always all this technical. We are trying. We haven't got it to work yet. So we are trying to do patch and MEA and imaging together, but we got a couple of patch and MEA together, but we haven't got imaging to work at the same time. Yeah. I think in Mischer's model, it's probably more cells than what we have. If we have more cells, then it's getting more and more regular, this kind of population bursts that it's probably governed by this adaptation and rebound thing. So, but in our case, we try to limit this to evoked very simple activity patterns. Was that a science paper or before? No, this is different. Yeah, this is different from that persistently asynchronous release. It's here asynchronous release is important for initiating this burst, this repetitive burst. So you have a burst, and then because of short-term depression, the burst is gone. But then asynchronous release persists. And so the next time when the threshold lowers down to the activity level, then you get another burst. And during this burst, it's the main driver it's still this synchronous release, not asynchronous release. But in asynchronous release, the role here is mainly to fill the gaps. So to make sure it can initiate, reinitiate.
Okay.
Thank you.